Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
This is community radio. Volunteers and listeners make this radio station happen.
Donalana Kitchen show is sponsored in part by Practical Farmers of Iowa, a membership-based, farmer-led, nonprofit organization that has been strengthening farms and communities through farmer-led investigations and information sharing since 1985. You can find out more at their website, www.practicalfarmersofiowa.org.
Joining us at our kitchen table today is someone who knows a lot about food and food distribution and apples. Her name is Susan Futrell.
Right, and I wanted to introduce Susan and talk about, she has had a long food career in the natural products industry. She is currently works and has for many years for the nonprofit Red Tomato, which is actually in New England, right?
Just south of Boston.
Right. So, but Sue lives in Iowa City, so you do a lot of back and forthing. And her book about apples, which is what we're going to talk about today, the Good Apples, she has dealt with the growing conditions in New England, which are very different from here, somewhat anyway, more pesticide pressure.
Actually, you ask me a little more about that. The growing conditions in the Midwest and the Northeast are actually fairly similar. Where they are really different is in the Northwest,
yes,
which is where most of the apples grown in the U.S. now come from.
Sue Futrell has worked in distribution for many, many years. You were a, sort of a founding. Tell us what Blooming Prairies was so we'll know what you did many years ago and why you're so committed to all of this.
All right. Well, let me say first that I grew up in Ames.
That's right.
I grew up in a family that came from farming, but my dad worked at as an ag economist for the Extension Service at Iowa State. So I sort of grew up around agriculture and farming. And I got away from Ames right away after high school, went to that other liberal arts college on the other side of the state. And when I graduated, immediately came back to my roots and started working in food and agriculture again. So I worked for Blooming Prairie Warehouse, which was a cooperative distribution company.
An early natural foods distribution company.
Natural and organic foods before there were even organic standards.
That's right.
And we were owned, and our customers were natural food stores, co-ops, and buying clubs all over the upper Midwest.
That was also before the national NCGA, National Cooperative Grocers Association. This was the very beginnings of establishing an alternative market for food beyond conventional.
It was a fabulous thing to stumble into and spend
a lot of
I spent 24 years working in that network. It's what, in many ways, it's what people now are calling food hubs, organizations that aggregate and make it possible to buy and market local products.
Right. Mostly food does not go from the farmer to the market.
This is true. Only a small, tiny percent of us get to buy our food at the farmer's market.
Right. And the rest of it has to go through distributors. And actually, for the local foods, as well as the natural products and organic foods, distribution has been a tough nut to crack.
It is. It's complicated. It's the nuts and bolts. So it's the actual moving a product from place to place. So,
yeah.
And it's also typically a very low margin part of the industry. So not too many people getting rich in the middle there, nor on the farming end for that matter. So it's very challenging when you're trying to do something outside the standard distribution channels in the mainstream. It's part of the world I love because I love the practical kind of, and it's also kind of the invisible part of food. You know, you go to the grocery store, you see the end result, or even the farmer's market where you're buying direct from somebody, you see the end product, but you don't see a lot of what went into growing it or getting it there.
Or picking it.
So that's part of what I love, and it's part of what led me to write the book and call it Behind Every Bite, because it's, I hope, a peek behind the scenes of what it really takes to grow food, particularly apples, because I love apples.
Just tell us more about this wonderful book called Good Apples Behind Every Bite. You kind of come at it from, you're not a grower, but you get to visit a lot of growers.
I do. It's a good day for me anytime I get to go to an orchard. I wrote the book to tell the story of the families and the orchards and the people here in the U.S. that are making a living growing apples and that are the hands behind that wonderful piece of fruit. I love apples. I always have. And it turns out, as I started working on the book and talking to people about it, that almost everyone else also loves apples and has a connection or a story or a favorite apple. So it made a very good lens to be able to talk about some of the bigger challenges and issues in the food system, starting with local food and what's challenging and difficult about buying our food from close to home, but also some of the growing practices can be very challenging and variable depending on where you are and what you're growing.
And still are very – it's an ongoing exploration.
So, and my piece of the picture now is primarily marketing and helping tell the story of the products and the farmers, but marketing, especially in a supermarket setting, which is where most of the produce we work with at Red Tomato.
Tell us what Red Tomato is.
So Red Tomato is a nonprofit with a very strong foot in the business and market of distributing fruits and vegetables.
In New England.
In the Northeast. We distribute from farms all the way from Maine down to New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. and all the New England states. And my piece of it is the marketing. Some of that is storytelling, but marketing a lot of times is the quick, 10-second version that's about as simplified, often oversimplified, as you can get it. And another reason I wanted to tell this in the form of a book is that there's so much more to the story. There are real people, there are real complexities, and I think it turns out to be much harder to be dogmatic and sort of rigid about the way you think about your food, the more you know about the people who are actually producing it and what they're doing.
Yes, you talked to a number of different farmers, big orchard growers, small orchard growers. There are real challenges with bringing the fruit that we think that we need. Well, we need the kind that looks like the pictures. We like the apples that are the best. Your visits with these people realize that many times they just plain have to, we just had to lose a crop. And it puts things in perspective. They need to buy things to eat, too.
Yeah, there's lots of good farmer stories in this book. It really helps you not just to see apple farmers, but, obviously, and I'm sure you intended this when you wrote it, one can extrapolate just from the apples to all farmers have these same issues of weather, of geography, geology, lots of good farmer stories.
Good. Well, those are the stories I think that ultimately really tell the tale. And it's true. I, like many people who are listening or would first come to the book, as an adult, I got very interested in apples, partly through the farmer's market and the local orchard and the heirloom varieties and the sort of very specialized part of growing apples. And Iowa has one of the premier heritage orchards in the country. I have learned so much from working with the network of growers in the Northeast who are part of a program called Eco Apple that Red Tomato helped develop, helped me understand some of the growing challenges.
Yeah, you want to talk about Eco Apple and what it is?
And also I want to say that my eyes were really opened when I went out to Washington State and I met with some of the – what we think of as gigantic orchards are almost all family-owned. the processing is almost all grower-owned and cooperative. So those growers have many of the same challenges keeping a foothold in the market and holding on to their farms as the small pick-your-own, you know, nearby farms. So the ECO program was developed by a group of growers in the Northeast who use very advanced integrated pest management, biological controls, okay, beneficial insects. Okay. So integrated pest management is a whole suite of approaches to crops and farming that relies on the ecosystem.
So one bug that eats another bug, thick example.
There's a lot of that. There's pheromone disruption where you, instead of killing the insects, you hang little pheromones around the orchard that confuse them so they can't mate, fuse, they don't reproduce. And that is actually one of the main methods that's used in the Northeast because there are these big swaths of orchard. They can really do effective pheromone disruption
there. It is effective. I even use moth traps in my pantry at home.
Yep. In the Northwest, it's very arid. The disease pressures are much lower. And the insect pressures. Plenty of things love apples, just like we do. So the organic practices that are specific to certified organic are more effective in that climate. In the Northeast and in the Midwest, where it's more humid, the growing environment is more,
like
it's just more
mold
conducive
and things like that.
To, well, particularly insects and, plant diseases, fungus that you know thrives in that kind of growing condition. I mean, it's the same things that make this a great place to grow corn, you know, it's fertile and the weather's great, are good for insects and things that affect fruit trees. And on top of that, many of the treatments that growers use for commercial fruit are really oriented toward cosmetic improvements, you know, the sprays and things often are to get rid of bugs that do surface damage on the.
Like put little black spots on
your
apples.
Yeah, they put little spots or they dig a little divot in the side. Mm-hmm. So if you're a commercial grower, you can't really afford not to take care of that. So these are growers who are going to very great lengths to use biological and ecological methods, but didn't have a way to tell their customers about it because they're not certified organic, although there's a lot of overlap between the practices that organic growers and IPM growers use. Story.
So for an eco program, if they have a real pest invasion, they do have the option to use something so they don't lose their orchard, basically.
Yes, that's probably the main difference is that there are synthetic substances that are not allowed in organic orchards that the eco growers would be allowed under certain conditions. And when they monitor and the pests reach a certain threshold, they would be allowed a certain number of times at certain times of the season. It's still pretty, you know,
pretty
controlled.
Strange. Well, there is a place in the book where you're saying this farmer goes, no, nobody really wants to spray pesticides. You don't want it. It stays in your land. You're exposed to it while you're spraying it. It's not, it costs money.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and dare I say, here in the heartland, one of the challenging things for fruit growers, especially in the Midwest and the East, is that some of the substances that turn out to be fairly low toxicity and effective for them to use are also substances that have been heavily overused in row crops like corn
and soy.
So they're
not as effective.
They're causing trouble in the environment. Neonicotinoids would be a good example. And because of overuse in certain places, there's now a move to try to restrict the use everywhere.
It was a little eye-opening for me because, of course, we all go, Neonics. Neonics. Okay, everybody now knows they kill bees. Rah, rah, rah. So you're right. There is a big push to get rid of them. And I didn't realize that that would be very detrimental for apple growers, for example.
For certain kinds of issues, that turns out to be actually a lower impact treatment than some of the older substances they used to use, which are also now people are trying to phase out a class of pesticides called organophosphates that we now know are dangerous. This was one of the places where really realizing the complexities, the trade-offs, the actual people who are making these decisions made it a lot harder for me to be kind of all or nothing about something like neonicotinoids. Yeah. There's a lot of good science happening. The best science is public science, for which funding is slowly on the decline, on the decline.
You talk about that in the book a lot. Please elaborate about public science.
So one of the places I ended up after speaking with all of different kinds of growers and really starting to understand more the challenges they deal with is that as a consumer, if I want pesticide reduction in food, if I want not to see neonicotinoids used, I need to be a citizen who is willing to support publicly funded research, not
which is more
product-based research.
For example, in Iowa, more tax dollars going, as it used to our land-grant institutions.
The land-grant network of institutions is one of the primary ways that fruit growers and vegetable growers and farmers of all kinds really have of advancing their practices so that they become more and more ecological. And as we lose that, we push growers into other kinds of methods. So I'm a huge believer in public science.
For example, at ISU, when we have a shortfall, the university can't close all of its buildings or not use such and such a science lab. So they have to get private funding. And, of course, private funding comes from places like large agricultural corporations, Monsanto, for example, at ISU. And then the research is directed towards the products that those companies, they get research, cheap research dollars.
I think as people's value of public education and public institutions gets undermined in the kind of climate we're in,
that
we're really endangering a lot of things that matter to all of us, maybe without realizing it. The other place besides companies that funding comes from at land-grant universities actually is growers and growers associations. And because apples are a fairly tiny crop here, there's not much funding for apple research that can come from those growers. There aren't enough of them. In the Northwest, big industry, 65% of the apples grown in the U.S. and 93% of the organic apples grown in the U.S. come from one state. That grower community has stepped up tremendously to fund research chairs and programs.
At Washington State.
And similar things have happened in New York and some of the other bigger states. So I want to point to that as well as a way that having a diverse agriculture and more fruit being grown in more places. I mean, there are apples grown in every single state, including Alaska and Hawaii. And Iowa used to be one of the top five apple-growing states in the United States. That's changed. It's shifted. We're much more specialized now. But I think one way of restoring some of the faith in public institutions is also to restore some of our diverse and local agriculture.
We're talking to Susan Futrell about apples. And I want to take a little time here to mention this is KHOI Community Radio, and you are listening to the Donalana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the Heart of Iowa.
Thank you.
Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. That was some fine banjo music by Iowa banjo player Bob Black, one of my favorites. That was called Lady on the Steamboat. We are in the Donna Lana Kitchen today with Susan Futrell. We're talking about apples. Everybody loves apples, and she has written this wonderful book called Good Apples, Behind Every Bite. And she's going to give us a little reading from this great book. Have at it, Susan.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you today. We've been talking a little about some of the challenges in production and pesticides and meeting market concerns. So I'll just read a very short little segment that's a story from one of the growers that I work with. At Indian Ladder Farms, an eco-apple certified orchard in upstate New York, I got my first look at an especially vicious orchard threat, a disease called fire blight. The telltale signs are brownish-red leaves, completely dried and stiff, a branch here and there in the midst of otherwise lush green foliage, looking like they've been selectively torched. Certain tree varieties have been especially hard hit this season. In an orchard that's not restricted by eco or organic certification, this wouldn't have happened. The trees would have been treated, usually with a targeted antibiotic. But owner Pete Tenike tries to avoid using antibiotics because he knows some of his customers are concerned. Now that the trees are infected, the only thing to do is cut out the diseased wood. I ask if the trees will make it, and Pete says probably. But fire blight makes apples vulnerable to another disease, a fungus called black rot. That's now flourishing, especially on his Honeycrisp, which are particularly susceptible and also particularly valuable. So the decision not to treat for fire blight will have consequences far beyond the loss of fruit and branches on the infected trees we're looking at. It all looms, the extra pruning, disposal of the infected wood, the loss of more fruit and tree limbs, plus uncertainty next year about whether the fire blight is wintered over or whether diseased branches have been missed in the pruning and will affect next year's crop. Pete shrugs it off. He's committed to ecological production methods, and these are the kinds of risks he juggles constantly in this business. He's also a funny guy. When a few customers complain to him about apples showing a bit of scab, another disease that causes mainly cosmetic damage, Pete started carrying around a clipboard. He told customers when they asked that he was keeping a list of anybody who wanted perfect apples with no spots. He would grow a special block for them next year with just a few more sprays. And when the apples were ready, he'd let them know. Funny thing, no one wanted to be on his list. Pete loves to tell this story. His dry wit is the perfect way to explain what customers don't always want to hear. There are trade-offs in all of this.
Ooh, yes, there are trade-offs. Yes. Your experience as a distributor and a connection between people that grow and people that sell, it's a really unique experience. I have a question that I've been wanting to ask somebody for a long time. You know, over the past 10, 12 years, we've seen more and more little stickers on everything. And why are there little stickers on all my apples now? When I peel an apple, there it is. Sometimes it even goes into my apple pie. Why is that a federal requirement now, stickers?
No, but that is a great question. Because usually if you look closely at those little stickers, they have a little tiny barcode on them. And usually a little number. And they're there for a couple of reasons. One is that many, many grocery stores now use automated pricing systems at the register to speed things up, and they can track their inventory, and there's all kinds of amazing, things that they can do.
And they can do it apple by apple now.
And they can do it apple by apple now by putting that PL, it's called a price lookup number, a PLU number, or by scanning that little code. The other reason that more and more of those are showing up is traceability and concerns about food safety or interest in knowing where food came from. But really, I think it's the food safety driving the larger changes in the industry. So knowing exactly, what apple, what farm it came from, all of that helps trace back if there's a problem.
So I assume on the grower end of this, there's either a person or a expensive bit of machinery that goes ka-tunk, ka-tunk, ka-tunk.
You're exactly right.
Boy,
and
oh
it depends on the farm. Mm-hmm. Some farms with more kind of fancy, sophisticated packing lines have a there's just a machine as part of the line that actually puts the stickers on. And some of them are put on with a little hand, you know, sticker by somebody, just like you see in the grocery store.
So I can bring them home and take the stickers off. So thank
That's
you, apple
right.
growers. There you go. Another apple question. Quite a while ago now, something that was really kind of a watershed moment for organic awareness was the Alar scare. And in your book, you, at that time, you were kind of in the middle of it. You were on the phone dealing with people and the Alar scare. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, and you're right. It was a kind of a watershed in consumers becoming very aware of things about how their products were grown. I was working at Blooming Prairie then, and we were selling lots and lots of organic apple juice. Alar was a substance that was used not just in apples but commonly in fruit, partly to retain fruit on the tree so that it would ripen. And a study published by the Natural Resources Defense Council came out showing that not only were there health concerns around Alar, but they were particularly acute because of children who tend to eat a lot of apples and apple juice, and also because their body size is so small, are disproportionately affected by residues. So the report itself was much more balanced. It actually calls for public research into alternatives and different ways to support growers that NRDC was careful to put in there. But the PR mechanism around the report was very focused on all of a sudden, unless they're certified organic or you know the grower, your apples are poisoning you and your children.
Scare. Alar scare.
And I didn't know till many years later. I saw the consumer side of that. Sales of organic apple juice went through the roof. We had to ration the supply that we had because we had new customers that never had bought organic anything before calling us up and saying, can we get some of that? And we wanted to supply our regular steady customers, but of course also, you know, take the opportunity. So it was a crazy time. And it was one of the things that fueled some of the attention that went toward establishing organic standards and labeling requirements. What I didn't realize until I started working with these growers in the Northeast is that because it frightened so many people away from drinking apple juice or apples, pouring juice down the sink, I mean, just a complete bottoming out, many, many orchards went out of business in the years following that.
Right. Consumers got so scared they just stopped buying apples.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
And in fact, the specific issues around the way Alar was used I won't even debate the health related issues and research, but I think it was very much an example of unintended consequences that really kicked back onto where it usually lands, which
well, yes,
is the farmers
and the growers.
Yes, I would
say the National Resources Defense Council did not intend to put apple farmers out of business.
No, nor did – so one of the spokespeople that for the organization Mothers and Others that grew up around that issue as a proactive let's get pesticides out of our food was started by Meryl Streep.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think she either intended to hurt
She strayed from her Hollywood routine, and she was sent to Washington to testify. And there was such an uproar that afterwards, so Meryl Streep's married name is Gummer, and all she could say was, well, Mrs. Gummer went to Washington. I think she found it a not very pleasant experience.
Well, one of the good things that came out of that is that a group of these orchard farmers in New England called Meryl Streep, called Mothers and Others, and said, you need to sit down with us and understand what we actually do in our production to protect the environment and the people who are eating our apples. And you need to understand the effect that you just had on our whole business and industry. And she did. And there was a long partnership between Mothers and Others and a whole network of growers in the Northeast. An earlier program for marketing.
So Mothers and Others was an NGO that kind of mm-hmm. took this mandate on. Yep. They were New York City based, I believe.
I think that's right.
Right.
I think that's right. And some of the growers, Pete Tenike, who I just read about, was one. Some of the other growers I write about in the book were part of that early group that met with Mothers and Others, really looked hard at what it would take to help consumers understand better the trade-offs and also
the
what
nuances,
was really being done.
Yes.
And the Eco Apple program that I now work with was one of eventually one of the things that came out of
right.
that. So, yeah, it was an eye-opening time. In 1989 is when LR happened. Mm-hmm. Even more eye-opening for me, you know, 20 years later when I learned how it was affecting the growers I was working with. And honestly, just a couple of years ago, I picked up the phone and took a phone call from a customer who had bought some apples with an Eco Apple logo in the grocery store. She contacted Red Tomato and she wanted to know if they had been sprayed with Alar.
Oh,
it was a really interesting conversation because Alar's been off the market since 1989. It's nobody uses it anymore.
But
somehow
yeah.
she just like that was such a powerful message that it's still something that,
well,
that people worry
consumers
about.
Consumers want to know, and it is very, very complicated, and it's very hard to find good information and accurate information. I think that's one of the things Lana and I try to do a lot is explain the complexities and how does it, a well-intentioned person who cooks dinner for themselves and their family,
yeah.
how do you navigate all of this?
And I'm a very strong advocate for organic still. I spent a lot of my career working with organic producers and foods. I was active in the process of helping get the regulations written after the national organic standards
Absolutely.
Were passed. And so I never want this to come across as me saying that doesn't matter or that we shouldn't.
No, I call it the line in the sand. It's the only national standard that we have that is third-party certified, that is actually a legal statement of, you know, what it means. It's and we're not going to probably get any more standards like this through the kind of legislation that we have now.
I think if I have one takeaway that I want to come out of hearing and understanding these stories, it's that we're really in a moment now where to have the kind of food and the kind of farming that many, many of us envision, it does have to be something that combines the realities for the growers and the realities for the consumers, that they both matter, and that it's not really an option for us to say, oh, those consumer concerns about health, you know, forget about that. Nor is it an option to say, growers, grow your food exactly this way and,
no,
you know,
very,
too bad if your trees die. We really have an obligation, a responsibility, and I think a really exciting opportunity as a democracy of citizens to find a way to help support the growers and those people who want to know something about where their food came from. I think a much better, stronger, more resilient kind of food and farming system will come out of that approach.
It's a work in progress.
It is a work in progress.
One thing that I'll take away from your book is that it reminded me again, and I grow food. I just don't grow apple trees, but it takes time. And consumers need to know that it takes time. If something – you mentioned occasionally in your book, if something happens to a stand of trees, a disease, or even a lag in consumers buying a certain variety, they cut down a whole bunch of trees and start over.
Oh,
because,
amazing, yes.
Because the bottom line of what you can afford, can you have those trees growing? And trees, it's not like you put it in one season and have an apple
the
next
season.
No,
it's not like growing radishes.
It's a long-term investment. It takes time and it takes care. Right.
It does.
I wanted to also mention one more thing about the organic standards, that we have now had the standards long enough that there are several generations almost of people who do not know what the world was like before we had these kinds of standards and a kind of a line in the sand. And please think about that, you youngins. We need it. It's important. It was hard work to get it, and it's very hard work to maintain it. Even in the present climate, there's like lots of chipping away through Congress now, and it's political. It's not just agricultural.
Anything else you would like to say about your book, or
just a couple quick thoughts to close about the organic point that Don is making, which I think is true. Longtime friend in the organic movement, Mark Lipson, who said something I think is really useful about the organic standards and the
Mark
organic.
Mark Lipson is at Organic Farming Research Foundation.
Yep.
He also worked at the USDA for quite a while.
He did. He worked with Kathleen Merrigan at the USDA. And he said about the organic movement and the organic standards and all the things about that, they're important. It's necessary, but it's not sufficient. It's not the only thing we need to be doing to move in the right direction.
Mark
but
is a farmer also.
It is a key part of what needs to be included. And I just love that. The last thing I'll say, because I want to take the opportunity of having a book and sharing some of my thinking with people, is that in the course of doing the research, I stumbled on a funny little essay by Henry Ward Beecher called The Political Economy of the Apple. He wrote it and delivered it as a speech in the middle of the Civil War. Who knows why he felt like talking about apples? He was an abolitionist and a social reformer. But The Political Economy of the Apple, to Henry Ward Beecher, came down to apples being the most democratic fruit. That has stuck with me the whole time I have been writing and learning. I started out thinking of it as democratic on the receiving end, like, oh, everyone can have an apple they like. Apples are everywhere. Apples for everyone. And I ended the book recognizing for myself that he's also really talking about the other side of democracy, which is the obligation that we have as citizens to support and sustain a public good. And I truly believe that people who grow apples for a living, the scientists who research, those many, many people who support local and sustainable
food. It's not a get-rich business, no.
It's all of those people are doing something that contributes to the public good. And to me, that phrase, a democracy of apples, is something I'd like to leave you with. It's my inspiration.
Aww. Thank you for joining us today, Susan Futrell. Your apple book is delicious. Good apples behind every bite. You are listening to the Donalana Kitchen. This is KHOI. This is KHOI. This is the Donalana Kitchen. If you want to find out more about the Donalana Kitchen, go to khoifm.org. That is the webpage that has not only our fine show, but lots of other good stuff. This is community radio. I have found a fine recipe I would like to share. And thank you, Don, for giving me this book. This is a book called The River Cottage Handbook Number 2. Talk about it a little bit.
It's English, so it'll have some unfamiliar terms and some harder to get products. But basically, it's preserves by Pam Corbin, who is an excellent jam and jelly maker, and it just has in it all kinds of how to wisdom and great combinations. She's got the contents read seasonality, the rules. Jams and jellies, pickles, chutneys and relishes, cordials, fruit liqueurs and vinegars, bottled fruits, sauces, ketchup, and oil-based preserves, and useful things. So Lana has pulled a recipe out of here that she likes.
Right.
And we're going to taste it.
Because I just happened to, this was a great year for alliums on our farm. Leeks, garlic, onions, we just had bunches of them. And when you have bunches of them,
you got to do something with them.
You end up not just onions do keep, yes, that's good, and garlic keeps, but there's always some that have got like a ding on them, or you step on one, or it's cracked, or it's just a real funny looking onion, and you don't know.
And you can't keep those because the mold
right?
will get
you into can't
them.
Keep them, and people take them to farmers market, and people kind of turn up their nose at the funny looking ones. So I have a whole pile of onions, and I found a recipe for onion marmalade. Now, onion marmalade, marmalade is customarily made from citrus fruit, and I think of marmalade as a citrus fruit thing. So by the time I get this done, I'm just calling mine onion jam. For me, jam is a preserve that's chunky as opposed to jelly that is clear. So I ended up with this whole wonderful pot of onion jam. And although I found out marmalade is a French term, marmalade doesn't really necessarily mean citrus fruit. It just means fruit that is cooked for a very long time to a thick puree. But I still think of it as citrusy. So
besides,
I'm going to call
this
it.
This is a vegetable.
Yeah, it's a vegetable. Onion jam. And yes, this book, River Cottage Handbook Number 2 by Pam Corbin, thank goodness it's got a conversion chart from metric measures to the imperial measures, which is what we use. Oh, we use imperial measures, which is good because when you run across this recipe in the book reads 100 milliliters of olive oil, 2 kilograms of onions, 200 grams of demerara sugar, and
100
fancy,
sort of,
fancy, yeah. 150 grams of red currant jelly, cider vinegar, balsamic vinegar, salt, and black pepper. So you get here to Iowa, and besides making all of the changes on the measurement charts, I decided to up things up a little bit because this recipe is a size to make in one big skillet. You just cook it down, and you can it after that. But I've got lots more onions than that.
And so, not only that, you have that fabulous jam and jelly pot.
So I got out my Maslin pan, which is a big, thick bottom, big, high-sided thing. And I made a few batches.
How much does that hold? Like a few quarts?
Oh, yeah.
It's big.
I make, you can make like 4 quarts in it if you want.
That's what I thought. Almost
lot. But you don't want things boiling over. And what's nice, it doesn't burn. But to make this onion marmalade, and Donna asked me what kind of onions, and my response was, whatever looked like it needed to be used by the time you cut them up. And I even put some leeks in it. Same family.
Mm-hmm.
The trick to this is you sauté the onions.
So you did use olive oil.
Yes. Use olive oil. Sauté the onions, not in my Maslin pan, but I also have a big flat frying pan. And I love the term here. You heat the oil in a large pan over medium heat, add the onions, reduce heat, and cook over low heat 30, 40 minutes, or until the onions are collapsed and beginning to lose color.
Yeah, you don't want to fry them.
Nope.
You want a gentle, so they melt and just get, because you don't want any crispy bits in them.
Nope. Because that will change the taste. Mm-hmm. They would change the taste. The idea of collapsed onions, so that's a very good term. And then, actually, I did this in a few batches. I kind of took this recipe and kind of multiplied it by 4. Just because I had more than I needed, okay? And so I made batches and kind of set it aside in a separate bowl. So I had this whole bunch of onions. And, yes, I did cry a little bit, but it's more than worth it. And then it says onions, it says sugar. And then it called for red currant jelly. And I am darned if I'm going to dump red currant jelly, perfectly good currant jelly, which I find very hard to come by.
Yes.
So maybe in England they have currants up the kazoo.
Well, or maybe
here.
They run out and buy a jar of it or something. Well, but our currant jelly is very precious.
Very precious. So what do I have? Lots of crab apple. So
ha-ha.
There you go.
Close
in color, mm-hmm. And you don't want something that's good. You just want a nice edge of sweet in there. So I put in a jar. Well, by the time I multiplied everything up here, it's an 8-ounce jar of jelly. And then all of that goes into the muslin pan and cook, bring to a boil, and let it cook down a little bit. You've already cooked the onions enough to drive off quite a bit of the water, and it's cooking in the muslin pan.
That's not literally water. That's the onion juices.
Right? Yes. Okay. Yeah. And then it becomes gooier and gooier. And then you don't want to put the vinegar in right away. Wait until the end so the vinegar doesn't kind of like evaporate. She suggests adding the vinegar at the end.
And not much, I must say.
No.
From tasting this,
you
don't start to think vinegar immediately.
No, I didn't. I have made this before, and I overdid the vinegar, which ended up with, well, it's not an...
It gets a little chutney flavor.
Yeah,
then.
It could be chutney-ish, but this is just plain onions. It's so nice to just taste the onions. And I used kind of 1 cup total. Half cider vinegar, half balsamic. Just a little bit.
A red balsamic.
Yep, a red mm-hmm. balsamic. So mm-hmm. it was good. Now, I really like this onion jam, and I will use up more of my onions. I think...
Now, does it have salt in it?
Yes, it does have salt and pepper to
and pepper.
Taste.
Yes,
to taste.
I would always
there you
put...
have it. And Donna's just chowing down over here.
I've just eaten about a third of the jar already. It's some little crackers. It is fabulous.
It's really good with a roast, with a meat thing.
Mm-hmm.
It would be really good with that or just on a cracker. It's a little sweet, but it is pretty intensely
onion. I could see it with scrambled eggs for breakfast. Scrambled eggs and cheddar cheese.
Oh, we have got a new thing.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and some of this onion mm-hmm. chutney mm-hmm. or onion jam.
Yeah,
right
put this on your toast.
Yeah.
And have scrambled eggs and cheddar cheese.
You don't always have to have a sweet, although this is a sweetish sort of onion, but it's a nice savory thing to have. So onion
Sunday brunch,
jam.
There you go.
If you look up onion jam on the internet, you get all kinds of suggestions like this.
Oh, the possibilities. You could put herbs in it too.
Yes.
But you want to keep the herbs a little understated because the onion itself is a very subtle flavor.
Right.
So, like, you might put a few leaves of thyme in, or, I mean, people will go rosemary, but that's okay, but I would say go really easy on the rosemary. Mm-hmm. It's the mm-hmm. dominator.
Mm-hmm.
You could do, what else were you saying? Basil is great with apples and onions.
Oh, onions. When I'm fooling around in the kitchen, so my husband Joe says, let me try. So he starts a batch. But he went out and got some rhubarb stalks and put some rhubarb with the onion. And that ended up very pink, which is nice.
Uh-huh.
But that ended up more chutney-like because the rhubarb kind of asserted itself.
Oh, yeah. It would kind of walk right over the onion flavors.
So onion jam. Yeah, I'm going to try this again. And if I actually get my measurements so I can trust them. I will put this up on the website as onion jam.
It's so good.
It is just really good. And you'll be surprised how much a big pile of onions can cook down to not a whole lot. You have been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen on KHOI Community Radio. If you want to find out more about this fine radio station, go to khoifm.org. And the Donna Lana Kitchen even has a page there that you can find out more about us. There's archives, there's recipes, there's even some really nice pictures. And find out more about all the wonderful locally produced programs here on this fine radio station. You could support this fine radio station by becoming a member. We're all in this together. My name is Lana Noctigal, and I'm joined every week by Donna Prusgintis. We've had excellent engineering by Evan Taylor. Eat good food and enjoy life.